Hey, good morning. My name is Jeremiah. I'm one of the pastors here at Westridge, and we're thrilled to have you here. Go ahead and grab your outline. That'll help you follow along with the talk this morning. As you're grabbing that, I want to say hello to those of you in our parent viewing area. Thanks for joining us there. It's a great option if you have small children that you prefer to keep with you during the service. I also want to say hello to those of you who are engaging with us online. Thanks for joining us through that venue as well. If you'd like to follow along on your smart device, if you go to the Bible app, the YouVersion app, and click on More in the bottom right corner, click on Events, and search Westbridge Church. You can find this same outline there, and you can follow along that way as well. So we are in week number 6 of our series called Follow, and just like Ricky Bobby, we all want to be great, right? Everybody wants to be great, and I want to be great. I think you probably want to be great, great at something, great on some level. There's a phrase that I've heard a lot in the last couple of years. When someone is great, when someone does something really well, or when someone's great at something, and I've actually used it a few times myself, and it's this phrase, dude, you're killing it. Dude, you're killing it, right? And I sent a text to some of our band actually even last week. I was like, man, you guys sounded so good. You were killing it. Ricky Bobby was killing it. Those shoes are killing it. And killing it means this. If you're not familiar with the vernacular, it's, you know, if you look online, if you have a ripped body or a cool fashion style or career success or like a high level of achievement, going on envy, producing vacations and having fabulous hair, immense personal charm, you're killing it. Everybody wants to be killing it. Even at church, people want to know that they're killing it. So turn to the person next to you and say, dude, you're killing it. Go ahead. Yeah, aren't you glad you came to church today? That's right. And here's what's amazing. The pressure to be killing it, it keeps starting earlier and earlier and earlier. I'm not making this up. USA Today had an article recently that said, the 2-year-old daughter of Kim Kardashian and Kanye West, Little Northwest, was killing it when she got baptized not long ago. They're like, look at that 2-year-old at her baptism. She is killing it. That's crazy. Now, I grew up not too far from here in Buffalo. We did not kill it. I'm not even sure we wounded it, to be honest with you. I don't know if we knew what it was. So sometimes something happens and people wonder if, you know, killing it is really worth it. About 500 years ago, there was a son of a rich man. He was a soldier. He was actually quite a womanizer, and his name was Ignatius. And he was wounded in the legs in battle by a cannonball, and his legs were set badly, and they didn't heal correctly, and they looked crooked. And so he was concerned that, you know, that didn't really play well at court. And he was concerned that he might not be able to attract really beautiful women if his legs didn't really look that great. And so in an era with no anesthesia, Ignatius had his legs deliberately broken, not once, but twice, and reset so that he could have fabulous legs. Ignatius, you're killing it. Strange thing happened. While he was healing, he described himself as a man given over to vanities of the world, a great and vain desirer of glory. And when he would dream about that next military conquest, or when he would dream about that next romantic conquest, it made him feel great. It made him feel alive. And then he described that that feeling then would start to fade. And after he would dream about these conquests, he'd feel great for a few minutes, but then the feeling would fade and he would actually have this overwhelming sense of emptiness. And then as he was healing, he started to read stories of past martyrs who had given their life in the cause of Jesus. And he started to read about people who did noble things for God. He imagined doing something compassionate for someone, or he imagined being generous to someone. And what he found is that when he would revisit those thoughts later, the joy didn't fade. And the delight actually lasted at the idea of simply being compassionate or being generous or serving others. And so this sense of sort of serving others and discerning like what is noble and what is shallow and what is actually best for the flourishing of the human heart and the human soul is at the center of what came to be known as Ignatian spirituality. And so he gave his life then to studying and serving others and having disciplines of serving others, and actually founded and started what became known as the Jesuit order. I believe people need this more than ever. When I was reading about killing it online this week, there was one 20-something who said this: when I see somebody else killing it, I think, dang. And then 10 minutes later, I'm like, eh. This is a pretty articulate, modern expression of exactly what Ignatius went through. He's like, ah, oh, I dream it is I who have attained the vanities of the world. And then 10 minutes later, I'm like, eh. He's basically quoting Ignatius, right? In fact, killing it ends up involving a whole lot of pressure. And we know all about this. We compare other people's beautiful Instagram life with our real, dull, ordinary life. Are my kids killing it? Are my abs killing it? Is my hair killing it? Is my resume killing it? Are my vacations killing it? I think in our country, vacations have turned into a competitive sport. And the problem with killing it is it never stays killed. You gotta kill it tomorrow. And the drive to be killing it is leading us to overwork. It's leading us to anxiety, isolation, exhaustion, feelings of emptiness, feelings of failure. I read an article recently by a 25-year-old woman, 25 years old, who said she feels like a failure because she is not yet the CEO of a tremendously successful startup. 25. She's a failure because she's not yet the CEO. Killing it isn't doing it. In fact, killing it is killing us. But here's what's so amazing about this. This isn't just a modern issue. This isn't even like an American issue. This is a human issue. In fact, 2,000 years ago, the disciples of Jesus were anxious for the exact same thing. They wanted to be killing it. They wanted to be great. At one point, they're walking along the road and they're arguing about which of them is the greatest. Like, which of us is the greatest? They're literally having an argument about this. And you've probably had these conversations at some point, right? Where you're arguing with friends. I see this on ESPN all the time. Who's the GOAT? Who's the greatest of all time? Except it normally is, you know, is it Tom Brady or Drew Brees or Aaron Rodgers or Christian Ponder? Is it Michael Jordan or LeBron James? And every person from my generation knows it's Michael Jordan and it's not even close. Amen. Come on, preach. Now, I know kids today are tempted to say LeBron James because they didn't grow up in the most majestic era of NBA basketball. And that's okay because this is America and you have the right to be wrong. So, but the conversation Jesus' disciples were having with themselves had nothing to do with, you know, who's the greatest athlete or who's the greatest, you know, I don't know, camel racer. I don't know what athletes they had back then. But they were arguing about which one of them was actually the greatest. Like, as Jesus is gaining popularity, they recognize we're starting to gain some popularity as well. And they're arguing amongst themselves about which one of them is the greatest. Which one of us has the most stature and is gaining the most popularity and the greatest of his followers. And here's what you need to know about Jesus when it comes to our pursuit of greatness. If you're going to follow Jesus, which is what we've been talking about throughout this series. See, Jesus doesn't reject our desire for greatness, but he does redefine it. Jesus doesn't reject it and say, I don't want you to be great. He simply redefines what greatness is. And you'll be pleased to know, I was happy to learn this, that our struggles for greatness, that same sort of drive, that same ambition to be great, to be killing it, is found in the closest followers of Jesus as well. This is not a modern issue. This is not even an American issue. This is an issue in the human heart. Throughout the history of humanity, we've longed to be great. There's a drive. There's an ambition. And these guys were with Jesus in the flesh. They camped together. They ate together. They sat under the teachings of Jesus. They walked with him in person. And yet, they wanted to be great. They had this drive. They had this ambition. They wanted to be killing it. So much so that both Matthew and Mark record this specific encounter with Jesus. And we're going to look at Matthew's account in Matthew 20, verses 20 through 28. It starts like this. Then the mother of James and John, the sons of Zebedee, these are two of Jesus' disciples who we've talked about a few weeks ago in this series. They were fishermen. Their father was Zebedee, and they left the boat and started following Jesus. she came to Jesus with her sons, and she knelt respectfully to ask a favor. "What is your request?" he asked, and she replied, "In your kingdom, please let my two sons sit in places of honor next to you, one on your right and the other on your left." Translation, I want to make sure that these guys get their share of glory when you get yours. Now, here's the mom of James and John, comes to Jesus, asks this request, and can you blame her? Right? I mean, this is a good Jewish mother. She wanted the best for her boys. They've already left the family business to follow this unemployed carpenter around the wilderness. So she's like, at least, you know, I want to make sure that when they get to heaven, they can sit in the luxury suite. And Jesus answered by saying to them, "You don't know what you are asking. Are you able to drink from the bitter cup of suffering I'm about to drink?" "Oh, yes," they replied, "we are able." Jesus told them, "You will indeed drink from my bitter cup, but I have no right to say who will sit on my right or my left. My Father has prepared those places for the ones he has chosen." And in fact, Jesus' disciples did drink of this cup of suffering that he mentions, as almost every single one of them were put to death because they refused to negate what they saw. They refused to deny that they had seen Jesus rise from the dead. And because they continued to hold to that belief, they were put to death. But Jesus let them know, greatness is not found in that. That isn't what greatness is all about. So Matthew gives us this story, and then the next verse he says this. When the 10 other disciples, Matthew is one of the other 10, he's writing this. When the 10 other disciples heard what James and John had asked, they were indignant. They were ticked. Now, can you picture this? They're upset. They find out that James and John had just asked this of Jesus. And they weren't like, "Dude, you're killing it." They were like, "Dude, you kiss-ups. Bringing your mom to Jesus? Come on." Why were they mad? Well, they weren't mad because James and John had asked for the places of honor. They were mad because they had wished that they had thought of it themselves. See, there was no way they were going to give up the best seats in the house without a fight. So what does Jesus do? He hears them arguing, throws the penalty flag. Jesus comes in. But Jesus called them together and said, "You know that the rulers of this world lord it over their people, and officials flaunt their authority over those under them. But among you, it will be different. You who are my followers, you're going to operate different than the way that the kingdoms of this world operate. Whoever wants to be a leader among you must be your servant. Whoever wants to be first among you must become your slave." Jesus doesn't reject our pursuit of greatness. He does redefine it. Jesus comes along and says, "Hey, listen, if you want to be great, serve. If you want to be at the front, go to the back. If you want to stand out, step down." And then he gives his own life as an example. He says, "For even the Son of Man," that's a reference that Jesus often makes to about himself, "for even the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve, and to give his life as a ransom for many." He said, "I've come not to be served by others, but to serve so far, to serve in such a way that I'm actually willing to give my life away." Now, I hope it's not too early in the morning to wrap our minds around this. This is absolutely extraordinary. Jesus, God in the flesh, says, "I'm a servant. If anybody should be served, it should be him. If anybody should be exalted or adored, it should be him." But he said, "No, I came to serve." And you know what that did? It shocked people. It absolutely shocked people. Jesus says, that's not how my kingdom is going to operate. My kingdom is going to operate by serving. And in their minds, they're going, "But that's not how kingdoms operate. That's not the way it works. If you want to establish some kind of kingdom, this is not the route to take to get there, Jesus." Guess what? This is still shocking people. You want to experience life to the fullest? You want to experience a flourishing human existence and a healthy soul? The world says, then take. Have ambition. Have drive. Conquer. Rule. Consume. Jesus says, no, that's not how life is created to work. You want to experience life to the fullest? Serve. Serve others. And maybe you're here today and you've experienced at some point in your life, or maybe you're in a season of your life where you're experiencing the same thing that Ignatius experienced, where it feels like life is good. I don't have anything to complain about. I've been blessed with so much, and yet I feel empty. Jesus said he came to give us life to the fullest. But when it's all about you, it's not much of a life. Because you are not enough to fulfill you. You will always need more than you have to offer. And so the antidote for spiritual apathy is to serve. It's to serve. So according to Jesus, here's how to be great. Number one, recognize what is natural. Before we can even begin to think about serving others, we have to come to grips with human nature. Why doesn't serving come naturally? Because I don't wanna. That's what comes naturally, right? You know what I'm interested in? I'm interested in the things that are interesting to me. And I'm not interested in the things that aren't interesting to me because they're not interesting to me. And what I'm primarily interested in is me. And I don't naturally wake up in the morning, like my head doesn't pop off the pillow and go, how can I serve today? Right? That's not the first thought that pops into my mind. Even Jesus acknowledges the way that comes naturally for us, the way that is, that you know, the first thought that pops into our head, it's at odds with the way that his kingdom is gonna operate. And so he says this, let's review. You know that the rulers in this world lord it over their people. Officials flaunt their authority over those under them. That's what you do. And Jesus says, come on, guys, the way that you're behaving, how you're fighting with each other over who's the greatest, that's natural. I get it. It's just like the way the rest of the world works. That is human nature. And particularly in the era that Jesus was born into, it was a lot less civil than our culture, if you can believe it. A lot less civil. It was might makes right. Whoever's the strongest makes the rules. Whoever's the most powerful, the most wealthy, the most influential, they make the rules, and they write the rules in such a way as to benefit themselves. That's how every kingdom has worked throughout the history of humanity, and Jesus comes along and he goes, guys, we gotta recognize that. That's natural. It's the way the world works. You fight and claw your way to the top so that you don't have to be under anyone else's authority, because if you're at the top, you get to make the rules so that they benefit you. That's how the world works. And if I don't recognize what is natural, then what happens is I get a little bit of authority and I'm content with being selfish and using my authority, using my power, using my position to leverage that for my own benefit rather than for the benefit of others. A little bit of authority goes, that's why, you know, you've heard the phrase, absolute authority corrupts absolutely. Why? I know that when I walk into my kid's room and it's clean, it's because I said, do it. Right? I know that when projects get done with our staff on time, it's because I said, do it. I know that when I walk home at the end of the day and the recliner is back and the coffee mug is out and the newspaper's waiting for me, it's because I walked into the wrong house. The Apostle Paul writes about this in Romans 7, and he talks about this struggle. He says, there's this constant war going on within me between my love for God and my love for self, the stuff I love to do. And he says this, he says, I want to do what is good, but I inevitably do what's wrong. The things I know I shouldn't do, I end up doing those things. And he said, I love God's law with all my heart. I love God's ways, but there's also this other way that's inside of me that constantly battles. And I'm always battling it out. He lives with this tension. I want to do what God wants, but my human nature is right there. It's fighting for its own desires. When was the last time that you recognized what is natural within you? When's the last time that you paused and reflected on what is going on inside? When was the last time that you looked inside and did a little sort of self-evaluation of who you are and what your life is all about and what you're wrapping your life around? Are they the core values that you want to live out? Or are you kind of letting life, just the natural desires, sweep you into a current that you never realized you wanted to be in? When's the last time you just paused, did a self-reflection, self-evaluation? Can I tell you something? It can get ugly. It's not the most fun thing to do. And just because you decide to follow Jesus, it doesn't automatically erase selfishness. Paul is a guy who wrote letters, started churches, wrote letters back to churches. Much of what we have as that we call the scriptures or the New Testament are letters from Paul. And one of the things we read in those letters is Paul saying, look, I still have this internal struggle. I still every day have to recognize, even though I want to do God's ways, there's this other thing that's there's this other thing battling, there's this other thing fighting internally in me. And so when I recognize what is natural, I have to recognize and realize self-indulgence leads to self-destruction. Self-centeredness leads to regret. Self-absorption leads to emptiness. That feeling feels good for a few minutes, but then I'm like, eh. Like Ignatius. Yeah, it felt good, and then I felt hollow and empty. And once I recognize that, I can either work the system and live a selfish life, or I can do number two. Number two, fight for what is spiritual. Once I recognize what's natural and what's human nature, then I can fight for what is spiritual. You can run away and hide and live a selfish life, or you can make a commitment. Okay, I'm going to fight against that. I recognize that internal battle, and I'm going to fight for what's spiritual. It means once I recognize what it comes naturally, then the fight begins. That's when I say, game on. I've got to battle what comes naturally and decide I'm going to live my life differently. And so after acknowledging how the world works, Jesus paints for them a very stark contrast. He says, guys, this is how the world works. You know how rulers lord it over those who are under them? And Jesus' followers are like, yeah, we know. That's why we want to be the rulers. He's like, yeah, right. Do you know how like people with authority, they use that authority for their own benefit and they flaunt that authority to those who are underneath them, to their subjects? And they're like, yeah, that's why we're arguing, Jesus. And he says, okay, but among you, it will be different. Among you, you who have made the decision to follow me, among you, it will be different. Whoever wants to be a leader among you, this is countercultural to how the kingdoms of the world operate, guys. He says, among you, it's going to be different. In my kingdom, it's going to be different. Whoever wants to be a leader among you must be your servant. Whoever wants to be first among you must become your slave. Jesus says, you recognize how naturally you want to be at the seats of honor, have the authority, be the rulers, so that you can lord it over people that you rule. In my kingdom, it's different. In my kingdom, we don't operate that way. Can I confess something to you today? A little insight into the Jeremiah current here. When I get most disappointed with myself, it's when I realize that I wasn't different. When I'm most disappointed with myself, I realize I responded exactly the way that the kingdoms of this world respond. I followed what came naturally to me instead of fighting for what is most like Jesus. When I respond the way that the kingdoms of this world respond, that's when I'm most disappointed with myself, when I'm not different. And Jesus comes along and he redefines greatness. So that those who recognize what is natural and instead choose to fight for what is spiritual, Jesus says that's what greatness looks like. When you say, yeah, I know that this is how everybody else deals with each other, but instead of trying to get to the top so I can set the rules and lord it over people, I'm gonna try to get to the bottom and lift people up. And when you operate that way, Jesus says that's what greatness looks like. Do I obey God and serve others, or do I obey what's natural and serve myself? That's the fight. And when Jesus came onto the scene, again, it was the powerful, it was the wealthy, it was the influential whose lives benefited from the way that the world worked. We have problems in the United States of America. They had major problems. There was no civil rights. If you were poor, you were poor. You were born into a different class, that's your problem. And we don't associate with you, and that's just it. And whoever was the most powerful, the most wealthy, the most influential gained more power, more wealth, and more influence. And that's how the world worked. And Jesus taught something that may not seem that new to us, but it was very, very brand new to the world in which Jesus lived. He taught that power was not primarily for the benefit of the powerful. That was a brand new thought. No one had ever said that. Power is not primarily for the benefit of the powerful. No one had heard such a thing. That's not how things got done. If you're going to change this world and get things back on track for God, that's not going to work, Jesus. That's upside down. You're not going to establish a kingdom where power isn't leveraged for the powerful. You're saying, Jesus said, yeah, I'm telling you, power is not primarily for the benefit of the powerful. He would teach that wealth is not primarily for the benefit of the wealthy. I'm like, okay, that's backwards, Jesus. That's not how the kingdoms of this world operate. He's like, I know. Everything that you own, everything that has come to you has been given to you by God. He's the owner of it all. It has simply been entrusted to you to manage. And when you manage it well, it honors God and it grows your faith. Jesus says wealth is not primarily for the benefit of the wealthy. Jesus taught that influence is not primarily for the benefit of the influential. That your influence is not to be used to benefit yourself, but that your influence would be used to create a better world for others. No one had taught that. In fact, Jesus taught and modeled that power should be leveraged for those without power, and that wealth should be leveraged for those in need, and that influence should be leveraged for those without a voice. Who does that? Who lives that way, right? That's not natural. Who would choose to live their life that way? I'll tell you who. People that you respect. People that you would say are great. People who you'd say, dude, you're killing it. That's who would live their life that way. And here's what it comes down to. Number three, follow the example of Jesus. Now, this isn't mind-blowing information here, but this is how Jesus does it. First, he recognizes what's natural. Then he tells them, here's how my kingdom operates. And then he actually uses himself as an example. So here he is with his followers. Two of them have just presented their mom to ask on their behalf if they can sit in places of honor in God's kingdom. Word gets back to the other guys. They're upset. They start arguing because they want that for themselves. And Jesus uses this as an opportunity to turn things upside down and tell them what is really important in his kingdom and redefine what greatness looks like, what killing it looks like in his kingdom. And to drive the point home, he uses himself as an example. He says, "For even the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve others, to give his life as a ransom for many." He's like, guys, you can choose to believe this or not. This is how the kingdoms of this world operate. This is how my kingdom operates. You can choose to do what you want, but I'm telling you, this is the direction I'm going. Even the Son of Man, I came into this world not so that I could be served. I came to start a kingdom, but not so that I could be the king where the subjects serve me. I came into this world to start a different kind of kingdom, to establish a kingdom that would operate not the way the kingdoms of this world operate. He came into the world to establish a kingdom like no other. A kingdom that was rooted in the hearts and minds of people. Not a kingdom that was established through military might. Not a kingdom that was established through protection of its borders. Not a kingdom that was established through whoever has the most wealth and the most power and the most influence. An upside down kingdom where power was leveraged for the poor and wealth leveraged for those in need, influence leveraged for those with no voice. And unlike the kingdoms of this world, where the subjects were at the mercy of the selfish whims of their rulers, this would be a kingdom where the king would serve the subjects. And unlike the kingdoms of this world, where the subjects are expected to lay down their life in service to the king, this would be a kingdom where the king would lay down his life for his subjects. It's a different kingdom. It's an upside down kingdom. And because Jesus had not come to take over, Jesus had come to take away the sins of the world. Jesus did not come to lord over, Jesus had come to get up under the burden of mankind. Recognize what is natural, fight for what is spiritual, follow my example. Bump, set, spike. Now, here's what I love about this message. It's so simple. It's so practical. It's not always easy, but it's not complex. Serve others. And that doesn't mean that you have to, sell your house and move to another country and live in a hut to do it. That's not what it means. But if you feel like God is asking you to do that, we are behind you 100%. But Jesus also said this, "If you give even a cup of cold water to one of the least of my followers, you will surely be rewarded." You will surely be rewarded. What does that mean, rewarded? I think what he's talking about is just, look, you're going to experience the fullness of life that I came to talk about, that I came to bring. It's the way my kingdom operates. That emptiness that you feel goes away when you serve others. And it's not just I experienced a high for a few minutes and then it's like, eh. But when you live a life serving other people, what happens is you experience life to the fullest. So much so that even in the small things, if you just give a cup of cold water to one of the least of my followers, you will be rewarded. Jesus was the master of the small things, from inviting people to eat, to washing their feet, to listening to the hurts of others, speaking kind words, to looking someone in the eye. Maybe you even start this week by listening to someone who's talking to you without waiting for your chance to jump in. I love, one of my favorite comedians, Brian Regan, talks about the me monster, where he's like, you ever been in those conversations where you can tell someone else has something to say and they're just waiting for you to stop talking? And they're like, yeah, but you, me. He's like, maybe the best thing you could do this week to serve somebody would just be to listen and just fully give them your attention. Maybe you start serving this week by allowing someone else ahead of you in line. I know that's shocking behavior because that's not how our culture operates. Our culture operates like, okay, I'm gonna basically track both lines. That's where I would have been in line. And if they beat me, now I'm ticked. Because I would have been there, but I picked this one, and she wrote an out-of-state check. That's how we operate, right? Or we get giddy if it's the other way around. It's like, yes. Like we win some magnificent prize because we saved 30 seconds. Or maybe this week to serve someone, you just say, hey, go ahead. After you, I'll be patient. Maybe it's writing that thank you note that you've been meaning to write. Maybe it's loaning your car to a friend in need. What's the most practical way for you to begin serving others? For you not to operate the way that the kingdoms of this world operate and not to try to claw your way to the top, but to say, what can I do to find someone in need and to serve? Maybe a way to put it into practice is even to join a serving team right here at Westbridge Church, where you can tap into a regular rhythm of serving with other people, making a difference in the lives of others. We have all kinds of opportunities here, and this is not a recruitment talk. This is just this is what followers of Jesus do talk. But if you're looking for an opportunity to serve on a consistent basis, we have great opportunities right here at the church, where you can jump in and serve with a group of people and grow in your faith and experience the fullness of life that Jesus talks about. And do you know what? The more you serve, do you know what happens? As you take small steps of serving others, God brings about big spiritual growth. God says, you're getting it. You're getting it. You're becoming more like Jesus. You're starting to reflect the value of this king and this kingdom. You're starting to live like a citizen of that kingdom. Way to go. And the more that you do it, and the more that you build in a rhythm of serving others, of putting others ahead of yourself, of sort of deferring to others and putting them first, what happens is you begin to grow spiritually. You begin to reflect more and more and more the serving and generosity and grace of your King. You know what I'm convinced of? I'm convinced that God actually wants great things in our life. He wants greatness for us, and he modeled what was greatest and most important to him. Jesus said that giving his life for many was an act of servanthood. It was an act of serving. And just before his death, Jesus met with his closest followers. They had a last supper together. And he said, I want to leave you with an image. I want to leave you guys with something that when I'm gone, you'll remember this. Remember a while back when you guys were arguing about who was going to be the greatest? You remember that? Y'all wanted to be killing it. I want you to see what I'm all about. I want you to recognize how my kingdom operates. And he got on his hands and knees, and he grabbed a towel, and he washed their feet. And here's what's amazing about this. In this culture, that job, washing feet, was reserved for the lowest servant in the household. That is not a pleasant job. Because what would happen is they would wear sandals, and everywhere they went, they would walk. They didn't have vehicles like we have, right? They didn't have, Skechers like we have. They were pretty much wearing sandals, and they would walk everywhere. And they didn't have modern sewers like we have. And so there would be horses and camels and donkeys that would be walking along the same streets and letting off sort of, exhaust, if you will. And they would walk through that. So you'd show up at someone's house and your feet would be a mess. They would be gunky. They would be stinky. And so the lowest servant in the household was given the job of washing the feet of the guests. Wash all that junk off their feet before they come into our house. And so Jesus says, look, I'm going to do the thing that is normally reserved for the lowest of the lowest servant. I'm going to do that for you. He grabs a towel and he washes their feet. And even then, it was difficult for them to understand what was going on. So much so that Peter is like, no, you're the master. I should be washing your feet. And, don't wash my feet, Jesus. And Jesus is like, Peter, calm down. You're like a third grader hopped up on Mountain Dew right now, man. He's like, I'm trying to teach you something about how my kingdom works. And he washed his feet. And much like the disciples, we want the throne. Jesus says, go for the towel. Go for the towel, because the whole and flourishing life is found in serving others. Here's our goal. Genuine servanthood is without recognition and without reservation. Without recognition, without reservation. Serving like Jesus is simply a long obedience in the same direction. It's a long obedience in the same direction. It's not glamorous, but it is significant. And it will fill your life and make you feel alive. And that's why Jesus came, to give us life and to give us life to the fullest. And we enter into that life when we pick up the towel and serve. Jesus came into the world not to lord over, but to come under the burden of mankind and to invite you and I to follow his way of living. And if you're here today and you'd say, I have never said yes to the invitation to follow Jesus, here's what you need to know. If you've missed any of this series, go back and listen to some of these online, because here's the deal. Being a sinner doesn't disqualify you. Having doubts doesn't disqualify you. Being an unbeliever doesn't disqualify you. Every single person who first started following Jesus was a sinner. Every one of them had doubts. Every one of them didn't believe Jesus was the Son of God, and yet they followed. And as they followed, they discovered more and more about who Jesus was and how he operated. And Jesus invites you to do the same. He has invited you, he's invited me into relationship with himself. He says, just follow me. Just discover who I am. Just discover how I've created life to work. And here's what's so great about that. We've talked about this through the series. You don't even have to change in order to start following Jesus. It's just that once you start following Jesus, you'll probably change. You will start to become more like him. And as you begin to serve others, God says, you're getting it. You're becoming more like Jesus. And if you're here today and you have never said yes to the invitation to follow Jesus, to say yes to the invitation Jesus says to be adopted into his family, I want you to know it is not based on your past behavior. It's not based on what you claim to believe. It's simply an invitation from Jesus to discover who he is, to start walking in his ways, to start following him, to learn and discover who he is and become a part of his family.